Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello, it's Tuesday, 21st of April. I'm Andy Brassel, she's Jules Breach, and this is Jules and Andy on Football Ramble Daily. This week, ding dong, Mr. Sports Director's gone, or almost. We've got Rob Harris from the Associated Press joining us to break down the mechanics of the deal that looked like it's destined to happen.
As it stands now, the Premier League will be trying to delve into the backgrounds of the ownership.
It should be an absolute non-negotiable starting point that a state should not be allowed to own or run a football club. I mean, that really should just not be questioned.
So, Jules, how's your week been? Still on the mend?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Andy. It's been another busy week, though. And thank goodness for work, because it's the only way I know what day it is at the moment. Thank goodness for the Football Ramble Daily, because I know that today is a Tuesday because I'm talking to you.
Yeah, that is the best way of taking it in, I think. Right, let's get straight into it because there's a lot going on, and a lot going on for Newcastle United supporters at the moment as they're trying to get their head around the fact that Mike Ashley's more than decade-long tenure at the helm, I know it's unbelievable, isn't it, that he's been in charge that long, looks as if it's coming to an end, with another Amanda Staveley-led bid to take over the club, looking as if it's going to reach fruition, backed by the Rubin brothers and, of course, the Saudi Arabia National Investment Fund.
Yeah, I mean, this potential takeover at Newcastle is massive, massive football news. Newcastle are one of the biggest football clubs in England. But as you say, Andy, rather than moments on the pitch, a large focus for the North East club for the last 13 years has been the fans' relationship with the owner. But now the reign of Mike Ashley at Newcastle could finally be coming to an end after a deal with Saudi Arabian investors for a £300 million takeover appears to be imminent. So to clarify exactly where we're at with the mechanical process of how takeovers happen and where we are right now with the situation at Newcastle, we caught up with Rob Harris earlier on from the Associated Press.
Well, what Newcastle fans and Mike Ashley have discovered is that selling a club can be as difficult as buying one, because how many times over the years have we talked about a potential sale of Newcastle and one potentially brokered by the financier Amanda Staveley? So it seems like we've been here many times before, but it does seem further down the line now, with so many Newcastle fans drawing that hope from a document posted at Company's House last week. It's not a time for celebrating goals with no football, but for checking out the Company's House register to see when documents appear there. And that showed the financial relationship between Mike Ashley's side and Amanda Staveley, which showed that a takeover was in the works with a vendor's loan, quite a complex mechanism that, again, fans have had to get to grips with over recent days. But it now does seem further down the line in terms of Mike Ashley preparing to sell to the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, the public investment fund. It's now at the Premier League. They're assessing the suitability of the investment fund of becoming the new owners, which means they have to pass the owners and directors test. There is also going to be, if it goes through, a holding by Amanda Staveley, 10%, and another 10% by the Rubin brothers, who do have a connection with Newcastle because they have property investments there. But now it is all down to the Premier League and them determining, is this a suitable ownership to take over for Mike Ashley?
I mean, Rob, I guess our thoughts are, and certainly wider thoughts of supporters and football media, is that maybe this is a bit of a fait accompli. How has coronavirus and the current hiatus affected this deal, and how could it affect the speed with which the new owners take over the club?
Yeah, but the Premier League do say it's operations as usual there. They're in a bit of a quandary in terms of when the league does resume, but actually it gives them this pause in terms of operations to actually go through the process to determine the suitability of ownership. I mean, there's obviously increased uncertainty as regards to the finances of the Premier League for the incoming ownership because of the lack of clarity yet over whether the season will be completed. There is that hope and desire to complete the season. And as it stands now, the Premier League will be trying to delve into the backgrounds of the ownership. And it's not fully clear how much they do take in consideration some of those big, wider human rights questions, because in the long handbook of the Premier League, it does not include any reference to human rights. You might think it shouldn't do, but even FIFA actually now do have a human rights policy, which is said to protect their business dealings. They don't always abide by it, or you can still find things they're doing that don't necessarily comply with them. But perhaps the key thing people will be looking at, it's F1.6 in the handbook, which is assessing whether a potential owner has engaged in conduct outside the United Kingdom that would constitute an offence if such conduct had taken place in the United Kingdom, whether or not such conduct resulted in a conviction. And this all relates to the big wider question of Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is behind the investment fund, and the questions over how much he should be held accountable for the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Turkey a couple of years ago.
Now, the Premier League in the past seems to have taken quite a hands-off approach to that sort of stuff that you were talking about outside the country, like we saw Thaksin and Shinawatra owning Manchester City for a spell before the current ownership, for example. But in terms of actually getting this over the line, I mean, we've seen a potential takeover in Roma, well, another takeover that was meant to be a fait accompli between two American groups, sort of paused indefinitely because of the current uncertainty over there. I mean, are we saying that the Saudi group just have so much money that it's a palatable risk for them, and this can go ahead regardless of the current situation?
Yeah, I mean, it obviously depends on how available the people are. The Premier League do need to conduct the investigations, and whether or not effectively any of that has to be conducted in person. They actually have to go to places and to do anything on the ground, or whether it can all be conducted remotely. It's you know, a very complex one for them. Taksin Shinawatra is an interesting one. That was 2080, obviously sold to Sheikh Mansour. There were some suggestions around, looking back on that, that the Premier League did put some pressure on Taksin Shinawatra because of the growing concern about his conduct and in Thailand as Prime Minister, and the criticism of the human rights group. So it was quite interesting at the time whether or not actually the Premier League did softly apply some pressure, which ultimately led to that sale to Abu Dhabi, brokered by Amanda Staveley. So the names do keep recurring. But it is this question, you know, will Newcastle try to sort of actually say the distance of the Crown Prince from the running of the club is so great that actually he should not be a factor in there? Or do you actually go to the top of the sourcing of the financing and who ultimately might have a say on the fund and determine that's a prohibiting factor? And I'm sure the Premier League will be taking counsel from the government as well on this.
Well, on to though the other two parts in this ownership, aside from the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, we have Amanda Staveley, who you mentioned already there, and the Rubin brothers, who you rightly said has already got a connection with Newcastle because of their investment in property in the city. How important could the Rubin brothers be in making this deal a success? And do the other two parties in the group offer the right balance that makes this deal work?
If you look at Amanda Staveley, probably the questions are why it's taken so long to get a deal done. A lot of people look on the outside and think, if she's bringing wealthy people to the table, why are they sort of haggling over the fractions, the tens of millions, if they are so wealthy as they are? So, you know, it's obviously been a difficult time for Mike Ashley to try to conclude the deal. He's had public rows in terms of her inability to complete in recent years. You look at the Rubin brothers, who are, you know, incredibly wealthy, worth, you know, almost £20 billion through the family, and they do have those investments in Newcastle, which give them that connection. It's not just some people coming in from abroad to buy a football club and get to know the area. With the Rubin brothers, at least they are bringing in that local knowledge, and that might actually point to a desire from the Saudi end to invest more in the Newcastle area, to build up property investments, potentially to expand in the area. If they look at what Abu Dhabi have done with Manchester, they've built up the area around the Etihad. They now want to build a new arena there, the biggest arena, indoor arena in Europe, to rival the Manchester arena even down the road. So the Rubin brothers are obviously bringing that additional sense of knowledge to the deal and to the table. And it will be interesting now what football expertise they do bring into the club to achieve their ambitions, to deliver for the fans who have felt for so long perhaps that they've had stilted ambitions, or just sort of treading water, or fighting relegation, getting back again to the Premier League, but never actually sort of pushing on to get close to success.
Well, bringing that hope back to the fans is something that the fans are all so desperate for, isn't it, Rob? How much of a difference could this takeover make to Newcastle United Football Club? Can you see them becoming one of the game's elite players? And from previous big money takeovers that you've witnessed, how long realistically will it take until the fans do start to see a significant change if this deal gets put over the line?
It's getting those key transfers very early on, isn't it? And ensuring you make the decisions right, and you aren't just having to perhaps do as Manchester City did in those early days, which was throwing money at players to convince them to come to Newcastle. Obviously, it was very necessary for Manchester City at the time, given the status that they were. That big challenge always, convincing players to live in Newcastle rather than the London area, will always exist there. In terms of what they can spend, the Premier League has relaxed some of those spending rules that were in place in recent years in terms of how much you could increase your wage bill by, but you can still only lose 105 million over a three-year period, showing if you, you know, you can sustain those losses. And what's unclear at the moment, this would be a welcome situation for Newcastle fans to have, is UEFA financial fair play. Obviously, if they were applying, it would mean they're in the Europa League or the Champions League again. And what we're seeing around the coronavirus is a potential relaxation of those rules by UEFA that might allow investment to come back into clubs and owners to pump money in. Obviously, there is some criticism of that elsewhere in Europe, particularly Javier Tebas, the La Liga president, who particularly has a problem with state-funded clubs like Manchester City, like Qatar through Paris Saint-Germain, through the distortion, as he believes it, of competition. But even he's actually welcoming owner investment into clubs again if it reduces the debt. The thing is, if Newcastle do start spending in this uncertain economic environment, it could distort the market even more. But they could have this renewed financial ability, and it just depends what message they want to send out with that spending. If they want to build up slowly or accelerate the spending very quickly once the owners do take control, assuming that it is approved.
Finally, Rob, we have to have a word about Mike Ashley, because it's been a much longer spell at the helm than a lot of people would have expected, as you quite rightly pointed out. I mean, how will people remember him? And I'm not just talking about the supporters, because obviously so many of them are so pleased that he's on the way out that they're almost not paying enormous attention to the detail of who's coming in. And I think we can understand that. But from a media perspective, how is Mike Ashley perceived? I mean, he's someone who's got a very strong image, but he's very difficult for the media to get to know. And he always has been, predating his spell in charge of Newcastle United. He was the guy who, when he came into the club, tried to apply some of those general principles. Like, he wanted to monetize player interviews. He wanted to charge for that and create preferred media partners. How will you and your colleagues remember him, do you think, as chairman of Newcastle United?
The fact that Mike Ashley saw Newcastle as a business quite purely beyond the football club is probably what led to some of these decisions which backfired on the fans. Perhaps in those early days, he did try to sort of ingratiate himself with the fans, be the man of the people, the downing of the beer in the stands, and trying to sort of be that bigger figure amongst them. But then he sort of retrenched and became more of this sort of figure who divided the fans. Well, more than divided them, and so many are happy to see the back of him, whether it's his treatment of Alan Shearer, Kevin Keegan, the renaming of St James's Park. It shows what happens if you don't properly engage with the fans to avoid that sort of backlash. And you just wonder if there had been that engagement, whether it had been a better relationship with the fans. The criticism of the fans is the lack of spending at times over the years. The fact they've been profitable for so many years of his reign is something that in the business world would probably be celebrated, but obviously to fans, not seeing that reinvested in transfers and not really achieving much on the pitch is something that obviously went down so badly with them. But so much of his ownership, though, seems to have either been about trying to sell or raise money. And there's never been that settled sense where he's been able to sort of outline a wider vision. He's always been talking about potentially leaving when a trophy's won, or desperate to bring the financing in. So it's, I suppose, the most amazing thing is sort of lasted there 13 years when, probably expecting those early years, he wouldn't actually be hanging around long. And question is always, when do you sell? And now it's looking like a £300 million deal. They are sort of effectively looking secure in the Premier League if the season's completed. So probably now is the best time for him than ever to sell. It does show how badly perhaps he's gone down with the Newcastle fans, that they're willing to overlook all those questions around Saudi Arabia and almost get behind the country. Because they're so desperate to sort of see a new person take the reins to actually try to take the club in a new direction.
Thanks so much to Rob for joining us, really illuminating that, Jules. And there is something I think we're going to have to go back to, and I think it's the split opinion that there is over this takeover. And I think it's interesting seeing the responses of a lot of Newcastle fans on social media, because obviously so many of them are pleased to be rid of Mike Ashley. And as Luke pointed out quite rightly on the previous show on Football Ramble Daily on Friday, generally Newcastle supporters' complaints about Mike Ashley weren't about his working practices or his wider business practices, but about his perceived neglect of the club and about the fact that he took advertising off the club for free in terms of St. James's Park itself and stuff like that. So, you know, there's no suggestion really that Newcastle fans have at large, and, you know, we can't really generalize that much, have changed tack in terms of their judgment of owners or potential owners. And also, I tend to think that really, as Rob was pointing out, it's the Premier League's job to do a job in assessing what's right and proper in terms of the sort of people who are taking over and getting involved in the Premier League. Also, I think there's a degree of sympathy to be had for the Premier League, because I know a lot of people won't feel that, but I tend to think that the product, for want of a better word, has accelerated financially so quickly that it's been quite difficult for the Premier League to get a handle on dealing with this sort of stuff. I think the amount of money that is needed now to get involved in a Premier League club is so much more than it was even 10 years ago. You know, clubs like Chelsea and Manchester City, particularly, of course, in the last 15 years have really accelerated that. But let's get back to the fans. Now, I know some of those Newcastle fans, especially on social media, have felt kind of attacked in a way. I don't feel that there's been any massive judgment of the fans out there. No one's saying, you know, it's up to the fans to deal with this, although I do think it's reasonable for fans to have a view on it. And also, as Pete was saying again on Football Ramble Daily on Friday, he said that, you know, it might possibly change his relationship with the club, and I understand that not everyone will feel like that. I think opinion will be really split amongst Newcastle United fans. I mean, we heard that email on yesterday's ramble that Pete read out from the comedian Ben Vanderfelt, and I think the phrase he used was, "Would Sir Bobby approve of this takeover?" Which I think's quite an emotive and a very interesting way of putting it. And I think Ben framed it very, very well in his mail. But I think for a lot of people, it's not just different people who will have different opinions on the legitimacy or otherwise of this takeover amongst the Newcastle fan base. I think fans will be, a lot of fans out there will be conflicted in themselves.
Yeah, I think there's like this element of confusion from the Newcastle fans, isn't there? Because on one hand, they are excited and pleased to see Mike Ashley on the way out, which is something they've campaigned and hoped for a long time. But on the other hand, they're then reading that the potential new owners of the club perhaps are too good to be true, or maybe aren't what they would have originally hoped for. And it's something that Coucho Club tweeted us about on Twitter, Samp_champ. He says, "Hi Andy, as a lifelong Newcastle fan, I'm finding the way journos react to the takeover hard to work out. Whilst I understand that the Saudi regime isn't pretty reading, as a fan base, I'm unsure as to what we're to make of this. Several journalists who work for The Independent have made a point to lament and critique Newcastle fans for wanting the takeover, but yet they hailed it as the sporting jewel in the Saudi Empire when it was Manchester United in question. Please help a confused Geordie work out what the hell is going on." And you can really understand where Samp Champ Coucho Club is coming from there with his tweet. And I think the question really I want to know is, how can these new owners win over the Newcastle fans, Andy? What do they have to do?
I think they'll do it pretty easily, to be honest, Jules. One, by investing in players, which is important for all fans. And two, by making links with the community, which, as Rob quite rightly pointed out, is something that Mike Ashley plainly failed to do. His whole business model was to just ignore shareholders and stakeholders and get on with things. And that was always his business model pre-Newcastle United. So, look, I understand that, you know, as fans, we can react to owners and shareholders simply by the way they treat our club. And I think it's reasonable to do that. And funnily enough, I don't think that many people have criticised Newcastle United fans out there. I don't think people have criticised Newcastle United fans for welcoming the takeover or for being glad to be rid of Mike Ashley. But I think as well, we do owe it to ourselves as fans to question the people running our club and not to be unconditional cheerleaders for them. And I can completely understand fans who have reservations about Saudi Arabia's human rights record, but on the other hand, are happy to judge the owners on what they do for a club and how they interact with the local community, because, you know, it's hard to make judgments on stuff sometimes that's not on your doorstep. And I don't think many media out there, despite the perception, have really attacked Newcastle United fans for that. And I think John Nicholson wrote a really great piece for Football 365 yesterday, where he said, you know, you've got to understand that people with different points of view are not attacking you. And that's a really great point to make. And that as football fans, we should be thinking about the greater good, and especially at a time like this, we should be thinking about protecting each other. And part of that is questioning the motives of people in power. And that's not jealousy. That's not saying, oh, right, that club's got loads of money now and they're going to buy loads of brilliant players, and so we're going to get stuck into them. I think as a fan, you have a duty to ask questions about the people who are the custodians of your club, because that's what they are. They're the custodians. You, as a fan, you stick with your club for life. You're going to be there forever. In 10 years, 20 years, however long, maybe they're not going to be there, but you're still going to be there. So what the future of your club is and what the motivations of the people running your club are is something that's very important. And, you know, I speak about this from personal experience. If you go back to the late 90s, when two, for the time, insanely rich Norwegian guys took over Wimbledon shortly after. They bought John Hartson for £7 million, but they had other motivations. So people were right, or would have been right, to ask questions. We spoke about Thaksin Shinawatra before, didn't we? And I think I remember quite clearly, like, the night that Mike Ashley took over Newcastle United. I think it was a 31st of January, if I'm not mistaken. It's right at the end of a transfer window. And I've got a lot of friends and family members who are Newcastle United fans. And there was a load of us in the pub, because there were Premier League games on this week. And because of Ashley being a guy with money who was taking over, and because of the prospective return of Kevin Keegan as well, my Newcastle United supporting friends were celebrating the arrival of Mike Ashley. And now that sounds totally weird, doesn't it? Doesn't it, Jules?
Yeah,
knowing then what we know now. One of my other good friends who was with us that night, one of my oldest friends actually, who used to be a business journalist, he was sat there saying, look, I know you're excited and you think there's going to be a period where it's not Freddie Shepherd taking money out of the club, but now someone investing in it. Mike Ashley is someone who does not care about stakeholders, and he will not care about what you think, and he's not going to plow loads of money in the club. And I just didn't want to listen. And I understand that, because football and football supporting is about hope. But I think, much as they're pleased to get rid of Ashley, I don't think it's fair. At the same time, as I don't think Newcastle United fans are being attacked for being excited, I don't think it's unfair for other fans or fans of other clubs to say, well, look, it's your club. Ask some questions.
Yeah, and I also think that there is, as you say, Andy, there is positivity around this takeover because it almost got to a point where any owner would be better than Mike Ashley for the Newcastle fans. So this news has actually greeted the Newcastle fans with some positivity. I know Jermaine Genus wrote in the Mirror a few days ago saying that this could revolutionise Newcastle United. There was also an interesting piece in yesterday's Guardian by Louise Taylor, who said that this would be a chance to make Newcastle a seriously big club again. And she spoke to some former players. She spoke to some fans as well. And there are concerns, of course, about the Saudi Arabian investment. However, there is a lot of positivity around this. And Alex Hurst, who's the chair of the Newcastle Supporters Trust, said that as supporters, what we want to see from our new owners is that the club is being run in a sustainable, transparent and ambitious manner. The involvement of Saudi Arabian wealth in the takeover is not a concern right now, and ultimately any new owners will be judged like all owners are judged, and that is by how they treat the fans and how they run the football club. Getting those two things right is the most important thing. And I think that's right, because football really is about that dream, that hope, the faith that you have that you'll go to a match and get that buzz from seeing your team do well, or from a win over a rival, or potentially going far in a tournament, or whatever that might be. But under Mike Ashley, it just seemed like that hope and that faith that's so important to football fans had just been lost for such a long time, Andy. So I guess the question is, will that hope return with this takeover? And it sounds like from the fans the pieces I've been reading, from that piece in The Guardian, from the fans that Louise interviewed, that hope is returning already just by a potential takeover. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens if this deal does get put over the line.
It will be, Jules. And I think sometimes there's a misunderstanding of what Newcastle United fans expect from people outside Newcastle. I think people look at them as a club and think they have unreasonable expectations, certainly in terms of when you tally that up with what they've won over the, or haven't won over the last 40 or 50 years. But in my experience, Newcastle United fans simply want, post Ashley, their club not to be neglected. And that's why I guess a lot of journalists out there are bringing up the motivations and the human rights record of the major shareholder, because in terms of what they're able to do for the club, I don't think there's actually much doubt about it. I'm not expecting, at least, them to go out there and buy Kylian Mbappe, for example, but what they are going to do is make the fans feel part of it, invest in the community. And that's, of course, like critics would say, that's how this kind of soft power works. That's how the regime at Manchester City, for example, have got a lot of local support. Now, it'd be interesting to see what sort of form that takes, because I think when you look at Manchester City, because of the City of Manchester Stadium, now the Etihad, they were presented with a sort of blank canvas to do that. And they've, created this whole Etihad football campus and developed the area all around that. Now, people who know St. James's Park will know it's very different, because it's right in the city centre and there's no real place to build around that. So I guess this is where, and again, Rob talked about it, this is where the Rubin brothers come in, because they already have their property interests and local understanding and local knowledge. They're invested in Gosforth Park Racecourse, which is 3 miles down the road. So that's where I guess the wider vision comes. But I don't think that Newcastle fans are expecting them to go mad and win the league. And I think in terms of what they would regard certainly as short to medium term success. It's not about, and this is taking away the moral questions over the sources of the money and all the rest of it. What I suspect most Newcastle United fans will want is just to feel that the ownership actually gives a shit about the club and the fans and doesn't totally neglect it. And, you know, it's something that I think we've seen season after season after season with Newcastle. And, you know, of course, there have been the relegations when Ashley has like completely neglected the investing in the playing side of it. But they want to feel that, yeah, there's hope, that there's focus, and there's a sense of the club wanting to connect to the fans and understanding that excitement is what it's about. It's not about winning every single year. It's about feeling that there's ambition, that there's progression, that there's connection with the community. All those things matter.
It's an incredibly difficult subject because the Premier League are responsible for opening the doors to places where just any money, anywhere.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
This is Jules and Andy on Football Ramble Daily. We're going to get to some of your correspondence shortly. You can tweet us every week at Jules Breach, at Andy Brassel, at Football Ramble on Twitter. Or, of course, you can email us, julesandandy@footballrambledaily.com. Just to get through a couple of the other bigger news stories this week in the world of football involving the players, and something that's developed over the last 24 hours is that Arsenal became the first club to agree a 12.5% wage reduction during the coronavirus lockdown. However, Mesut Ozil is among three Arsenal players who have rejected taking that pay cut. Now, it's believed that with these pay cuts, that the players would then receive that 12.5% back if Arsenal were to make it into the Champions League places, and they'd receive half of that if they made it into the Europa League places. So Mesut Ozil and a couple of the other Arsenal players have obviously decided that this wasn't for them. For now, let's point out, these are the facts for now up until this day. This could all change. They could change their minds. There could be a good reason as to why they've decided not to follow suit with the rest of the squad. But what do you think of this, Andy? And how do you think this reflects on Mesut Ozil?
Well, I think people will perceive things, especially with players, as they want to perceive them. And people have a certain view of Mesut Ozil. They view him as someone who is the highest earner at Arsenal, who's no longer that important to them, who refuses to leave and is therefore a mercenary. I think that is not only wrong, it is at best a gross oversimplification of the facts. And I think... correlate what you perceive him to be as a player at this stage in his career and his on-pitch usefulness to Arsenal with this issue, they're two totally different things. I don't think you can tie them together. Now, I think if we go backwards, actually, to a previous Ramble Meets that Luke did with Dr. Sürgüt, who is his main advisor. It was very interesting and very illuminating on Ozil's off-pitch activities and motivations. And Mesut Ozil is one of the most socially conscious footballers that really you can think of from the elite bracket of footballers. You know, this is a guy who gave up $250,000 worth of World Cup bonuses so he could pay for medical bills for Brazilian children. You know, he is a guy whose social consciousness, for which Arsenal have hung him out to dry before, I might add, and charitable work speaks for itself. I don't think it's unreasonable for players, and we've seen it with Toni Kroos as well. I don't think it's unreasonable for players, as we were saying before at the start, to ask questions of the owners, to say, okay, well, if we are cutting pay, where's it going? Because Stan Kroenke, since he's run Arsenal, has talked a lot about the smooth running and the profitability of the club. And a lot of fans would argue that money has not been deployed effectively to make Arsenal challengers. Now, this is a different issue, of course, because we're talking about keeping non-playing staff going, which is obviously hugely important. But bear in mind that when Barcelona, who were one of the first elite clubs to moot a pay cut, although it took a while to effect it after that, they had a 72% pay cut, Barcelona's players. And yet, the union of non-football workers at Barcelona, so like non-playing staff, be it all across their administrative operations and everything else, came out and said, okay, well, the players have given up all this money, but we've not heard anything yet. And I don't think it's unreasonable for a player, especially a player who's smart as Mesut Ozil, to say, well, you know, where's this money going? If you cut this money, does that mean less tax goes to the NHS? The idea of him just hoarding his money, I don't think is consistent with his personality or consistent with his actions. So by all means, think that Mesut Ozil is a playing dead weight. By all means, think he's past his best. By all means, think that Arsenal would be better off without him. That's fine. You can have those opinions. But to say that Mesut Ozil is simply selfish and greedy just because he wants to know more about where that money's going, which I strongly suspect to be the case with him, I think that's really unfair.
Yeah, I completely echo that, Andy. And on to some positive news for a player during the coronavirus pandemic. Ashley Young is set to sign a one-year contract extension at Inter Milan. Now, this isn't something that I thought we'd be talking about during this pandemic, that there would be contract extensions or new contracts being put in place. But that is the case for the former Manchester United captain. And it's really good to see, because he'd only made 7 appearances for Inter before the football in Italy had shut down. And he'd obviously impressed the manager, Antonio Conte, and they've decided to give him a contract extension. He originally signed for an initial 6-month contract, but now they're set to extend this till 2021. And this is just quite good news to read, isn't it, Andy? Because we've not seen anything like this in the press for probably the last month.
No, it's terrific. And I think Ashley Young has done a brilliant job since he's been there. Antonio Conte loves him. The rest of the players love him. I think that versatility and the fact that you really get a shift out of him. Remember, he's wearing the armband at Manchester United at one point. His leadership qualities are not in question. I think it's really terrific. I personally, Jules, and obviously I have my certain European football interests, I find it very exciting when you get English players, and we've seen it with Chris Smalling as well, and obviously other Manchester United players who've sort of hit a bit of a plateau in their Old Trafford career, go and restart things in Italy. I have to say, I find it immensely exciting when you get a player like that, especially a player who's into his mid-30s now, go and get this new lease of life over there. And that's really what he's had, isn't it? Of course, it's all about assimilating to the lifestyle and the culture as well. And something I really loved, actually, which, you know, not all tweets age well, but this one from Ashley Young, where he talked about lockdown, and this was before we had full lockdown in the UK, actually. And he wrote, this may sound harsh, but treat everybody that's not in your household as if they have the virus. You just don't know. More importantly, just stay safe. That's what we're doing here in Italy. It's not an overreaction. It's just staying safe. And just remember, others should be looking at you in this way as well. And it's a way of keeping your distance to ultimately help save lives. And a few people at the time, I remember saying, oh, what's he talking about? And I understand it's easy to look at in retrospect, but I think the fact that it shows that he's part of Italian life, it shows that he's really engaged. I think it shows what he's like as a guy as well, that idea of leadership and that idea of wanting the best for other people. It's something that I really took from that, and I thought that was terrific from Ashley Young.
Yeah, so it's about setting examples, isn't it? And yeah, as we've said previously on Jules and Andy, is that these footballers, they are idols to people. And if their fans are seeing that, they're saying, you know, isolate, this is the best thing you can do. This isn't a horrible thing. It's just what we have to do right now. Keep your distance. Ultimately, that will help save lives. Then that is setting an example. And what's interesting is that, as you say, Andy, at the start, people were kind of a bit like, is this a bit of an exaggeration? And the fact is that at the time, for us here in England, because Italy were a few weeks ahead of us in terms of the coronavirus pandemic, we probably did all see it as a bit like, oh, that seems a bit over the top. But actually now that we're in a similar situation to what Italy were in a month ago, right now, we now understand that why that tweet was written, and we understand just how important it is to stay safe at this time and to stay indoors. And obviously someone like Ashley Young setting an example there, which is a really good thing to see. Let's just finish things off today, Andy, with a few tweets, because loads of you have been in touch. In fact, a lot of the tweets and the questions we were asked this week were about the potential takeover at Newcastle. So hopefully we've answered your question. But just a little one off that subject. Stephen Kilby says, you've both been to so many grounds around Europe. Which has been the best atmosphere for a game, and why, and which places should be on my list? He said, thanks so much for keeping the pod going. You guys are awesome. Thank you very much, Stephen. Andy, from all of the Champions League grounds that I visited, I think the ground atmosphere that I enjoyed the most had to be at Borussia Dortmund. I will never forget my experience there. I've only been once, but it was incredible. It's like nothing I've ever experienced before at any other football ground. Just the colour, that vibrant yellow, that wall of fans that are so loud and so intimidating. I've never gone pitch side to do my links before at any football ground, other than I'd probably say the Nou Camp, where I've stood there and gone, oh, this is tense, and this is going to be intense for the players. The fans just feel like they are imposing on you at Dortmund, and I just thought it was an incredible ground, amazing atmosphere, and definitely one that you have to visit, Stephen.
I'm on board with that. It's a great choice, Jules. It's always special at Dortmund. My other ones would be Galatasaray, which is in the Guinness Book of Records for being the loudest sports stadium in the world.
Is it really? I didn't know that.
And I did an at the match there last year. Yeah, like last May for Galatasaray Beşiktaş, and interviewing my good friend Emre Okajan. And like at the time, I was thinking, are we going to get any of this for the pod? In the end, it sounded amazing. I was interviewing him in the stadium, probably 45 minutes before kickoff, and the noise was deafening. We could barely hear each other, but it sounded great in the end. You can go back and listen to that episode on the Continent feed. And the other place I would say is Marseille, because the sheer noise when a goal goes in is astonishing. And the first time I went there, there wasn't even a roof on it, whereas now they've got the roof on as well, and they're doing a bit better on the pitch as well, which probably makes a difference. But yeah, it's a tremendous atmosphere there. Strongly recommended when we can all get out and about. And that noise, of course, when a goal goes in, takes us back to the beginning of the pod into Newcastle United, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. Well, thank you everyone for getting in touch with us this week. Please get your questions in for next time round. We'll of course be back this time next week, despite the fact we don't know what day it is. We will be here next Tuesday with lots more rambling. Andy, good to see you. And I didn't see you today, but good to speak to you as always. Have a nice week, keeping yourself busy. What are you getting up to?
I'm waiting for loads of mails and correspondence from the Ramblers at Jules Breach, at Andy Brassel, Jules and Andy at footballrambledaily.com. Of course, we'll be back on Thursday, me and Luke Moore for On the Continent, and I'll speak to you next Tuesday, Jules.
Yeah, speak to you then. Remember, if you don't send any tweets in, Andy's just going to be sat on his sofa twiddling his thumbs, so you better get them in. See you next week.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.